Now we'll ask Uncle Brian to come forward and speak to us on the subject, peace. Peace to him that is afar off and to him that is near.
Thanks, Brother Glenn. Well, that wasn't an easy reading, was it? The 57th chapter of Isaiah. And I'm sure that as we read that chapter, we're wondering how all that is going to work out. So this should make it a very interesting class, even if not one of the easiest of chapters. If you've got your pen there, just a few headings to give you some of the basic breakup of the chapter. Verses 1 to 2. Though the righteous perisheth, yet shall he enter into peace. Verses 1 to 2. Though the righteous perisheth, yet he shall enter into peace. You immediately see that the chapter's got a wholeness about it, because it's on that very note, isn't it, that it finishes. So it's interesting, worthwhile taking as an overall concept. Verses 3 to 13a. A seed of falsehood. Or if you like, you could call it children of the groves. And then in the final section, the third section, have I gone too quickly? Want more time? Got it all? Happy with that? In the third section, we have peace, peace to him that is far off and to him that is near. Now, if we all got those little headings, they will be really helpful as we're going along. Now, what we have to note is the strange words at the end of chapter 56 and how they link on with chapter 57, verse 1 to 2. I want you to come back to chapter 56 and just see that this is sort of hard to understand. It's not immediately easy at all. Does verse 9 to 12, does that bracket belong really with the rest of the sense of chapter 56? You'll notice that it's to the leaders. All ye beasts of the field, come to devour. Yea, all ye beasts in the forest. That is the Gentile powers. In the fifth chapter, the chapter about the vineyard, the beast and the wild boar comes over, doesn't it? The borders of the vineyard. So there's a call, verse 9, to invasion. Invasion by Gentile forces. What's in the main problem? Verse 10. His watchmen are blind. Israel's watchmen. They are ignorant. They are all dumb dogs. You have a dog so that he'll sound out in the night when the burglar's stalking the place, don't you? But if he doesn't make a noise, he's not much use. They cannot bark. Sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber, instead of being concerned about the cares of the house, they are more interested in their own well-being. Yeah, they are greedy dogs which can never have enough, and they are shepherds. So what were in verse 10? Watchmen are in verse 11, shepherds. They all look to their own way, everyone for his gain from his quarter. So just as the description of the dogs, so also the description here of the shepherds. Not concerned about anything else than their own wanton interest. Come ye say they, I will fetch wine, and we will fill ourselves with strong drink, and tomorrow shall be as this day, and much more abundant. In other words, there's a sense of uniformitarianism, as we often describe it, described in 2 Peter chapter 3. All things continue on since the beginning of the world, and why are we to care about that? Come ye, say they, I will fetch wine. We'll take all we like, and tomorrow we'll do the same thing, and no judgment's coming. Tomorrow shall be as this day and much more abundant. So there we have... Does that fan have to be doing that? Do we really need them tonight? Thank you. My pages in Isaiah are pretty feeble too, so I'm doing that all night. I'll be in pieces by the end of the night. Thank you, David. So, we have therefore the leaders in the last section of 56 that are particularly denounced under the terms of the shepherds and the watchmen. And because of their blindness, Yahweh invites therefore the beast of the field to come and to invade. Now you can see how 57 verse 1 and 2 fit into that. The righteous perisheth, and no man layeth it to heart. They've become an isolated minority. And merciful men, what a contrast they are, as the righteous are, with the self-seeking dogs and greedy shepherds and watchmen that we had before. The righteous perisheth, and no man layeth it to heart. Merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. He shall enter into peace. Despite the invasion, despite every circumstance, they shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his uprightness. So what is happening in chapter 57, verse 1 and 2, is this, that despite the invasion that God has foretold, yet the righteous will be secure. Though the invader might come, yet nevertheless he will rest contentedly in his bed. There's something to note about the general tenor of chapter 57. In the words that follow, verses 3, say, to verse 10, you have a most graphic description of idolatry, massive idolatry, even to the extent, verse 5, of offering their children, inflaming yourselves with idols under every green tree, slaying the children in the valleys under cliffs of the rock. The whole of that section is really quite remarkable. Thou wentest to the king, verse 9, with ointments, and didst increase thy perfumes, and didst send thy messengers far off, and didst debase thyself even unto hell. And there was wide apostasy, idolatry, all through the kingdom at that time, whether it is in the lofty and high mountain, verse 7, among the streams, verse 6, in the valleys, verse 5, or in the openness of placing their bed upon the top of the mountain. In other words, this is rampant idolatry. Now, that's not easy to work out in the terms of Isaiah's ministry, because in the first chapter, if you quickly turn there, you will remember that the last king that's mentioned as relevant to his period of ministry was Hezekiah. And we certainly cannot imagine that in the days of Hezekiah, verse 1, chapter 1, that such a rampant idolatry was in the land. So how do we fit these last chapters of Isaiah, and in particular this 57th chapter? I'm persuaded myself that in fact they fit very well the days of Manasseh, Hezekiah's son, but not the days of Hezekiah, or otherwise they're prophetic of the early days of Manasseh that were dawning. Come, for example, to just read some of the record in in Chronicles, the historical record, and see just how absolutely perfectly they fit. 2 Chronicles 33, this Manasseh was a very evil man. It's a very sad thing that this is the great Hezekiah's son, isn't it? Verse 3, for he built again the high places which Hezekiah his father had broken down, and he reared up altars for Balaam and made groves. Grove was a place surrounded by trees in which, as it were, one couldn't see what happened, as though one's actions were not disclosed to God. And worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. It's very concentrated idolatry, isn't it? Reared up altars for Balaam, made groves, and worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. And he built altars in the house of Yahweh, whereof Yahweh had said, in Jerusalem shall my name be forever. And he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of Yahweh. What an astonishing piece of effrontery. And he caused, verse 6, his children, royal seed, to pass through the fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. Also he observed times, and used enchantments, and used witchcraft, and dealt with familiar spirit, and with wizards. And he brought much evil in the sight of Yahweh to provoke him to anger. And he involved the people. Verse 9. So Manasseh made Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to err and to do worse than the heathen whom Yahweh had destroyed before the children of Israel. So he made Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to err and to do worse than the Gentile nations. That's a shocking statement, isn't it? Those verses are just the most amazing statement, but they correlate 100% with Isaiah chapter 57, whereas you could not say that that was the case with Hezekiah, who in fact had undone idolatry, taken down those high places, and brought people back to the true God. So this Manasseh then has involved the kingdom and right down to the very people. King and people were in it together. And his evil had picked up the people in its sway. In fact, if you look in, it's an interesting reference, in 2 Kings 21, it actually says that he seduced them. Chronicles says that he made them. And the way he did that was by seduction. In 2 Kings 21, verse 9, but they hearkened not, and Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than did the nations whom Yahweh destroyed before the children of Israel. How about that? He seduced them. So there's a very powerful expression about the iniquity, the depth of evil of this Manasseh. In fact, while you're still in 2 Kings 21, verse 6, we'd like, because here it uses the expression that's twice used of him, that he provoked God to anger. 2 Chronicles 21, verse 6, the last line, to provoke him to anger. And that's in verse 6 that mentions his son passing through the fire. Chronicles says there was more than one of his sons. It mentions also about his enchantments and familiar spirits and wizards and so on. So Kings and Chronicles got an interesting series of details. And twice it is stated, both in Kings and Chronicles, that he was the provoker. Of the kings, he was Manasseh the provoker. Well, in that situation, try and imagine Isaiah's life. How would he get on? Where's Isaiah when Manasseh becomes king? Now, we know pretty well for certain that Isaiah, in fact, did last into some of Manasseh's reign, because Jewish tradition has always said, in fact, that it was Manasseh who put Isaiah to death. But what's interesting is to try and think to ourselves, well, where is Isaiah with all this entrenched evil, this saturation almost of idolatry that's suddenly come into the land? Where is the old prophet and his followers? Well, if you look in the Chronicles record again, it is interesting to notice this, that there are two references. I say there's two references to Isaiah. Well, I might be stretching it a little bit, but come and have a look. 2 Chronicles 33. And verse 10. Who's that? Yahweh spake to Manasseh and to his people, but they would not hearken. Who spoke? It's interesting, isn't it? Yahweh spoke to Manasseh. Verse 18 probably indicates how that was done. Now the rest of the acts of Manasseh and his prayer unto his God, and the words of the seers, the prophets, that spake to him in the name of Yahweh Elohim of Israel, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Doesn't say this is Isaiah, but without a shadow of a doubt, Isaiah would have been the patron prophet around at that time, without a shadow of a doubt. So if anybody was making the message for the king, undoubtedly Isaiah would have been involved in it. So that's very interesting. And so when we come back to chapter 57, we can sense that the Kings and Chronicles records are giving us the understanding of the picture. This is a time now when a righteous man fears his life. And that's why it opens up in this way. The leaders have gone after their king. The watchmen have forgotten their carefulness. The shepherds have forgotten their flock. Instead of being seers, and the Hebrew word for seer is kozim, K-H-O-Z-I-M, they are now hozim. That is, dreamers, sleeping, verse 10 of chapter 56. They cannot bark, sleeping, it says. And you look in the margin, it says dreaming. In other words, the Hebrew word is that they were dreamers, hozim, H-O-Z-I-M. Instead of being seers, which is kohozim, a little play, I'm sure, there by Isaiah, as he often does, to make the point. Just the drop of the K has changed the sense of the word. And so the seers were in very grave strait. And as I said, history records that Manasseh did persecute Isaiah, and he fled, and he came to be found in the trunk of a hollow tree, and the king demanded that the tree be sawn down, knowing full well that Manasseh was that Isaiah was contained therein. And so the prophet is said to have come to his death. Can you remember a passage in the New Testament that would fit that? It's in Hebrews chapter 11, speaking of the prophets and other faithful people. It says, they were stoned, verse 37. They were sawn asunder, were tempted, were butchered, were slain with the sword, butchered. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins and so on. And it's said that that reference is very much likely to refer to Isaiah, because there's no other recorded reference to somebody actually being sawn asunder, except the case of the great prophet Isaiah. Isn't that a tragic thing? Think of the the prophet that gave this tremendous series of wonderful pictures may have suffered that ignominious failure. So all of that means that this section that we're dealing with in 57 and that last little section in 56 does fit perfectly into the time of the new king Manasseh. And chapter 57 verse 1 is saying, all right, they may perish and they may go unnoticed, no man layeth it to heart, and merciful men are taken away, but none considers that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. And the evil to come in that context then is, verse 9 of 56, is the invasion of the Gentile beasts, isn't it? In other words, they are taken away before the calamity falls upon the nation. Now, there is a classic case of that. Can you think of exactly someone who was described in exactly those terms? In the 2 Chronicles chapter 34, we have the record about King Josiah, and it puts it exactly in those very terms. It says in verse 28 of chapter 34, behold, I will gather thee to thy fathers, Josiah, and thou shalt be gathered to thy grave in peace. Neither shalt thine eyes see all the evil that I will bring upon this place and upon the inhabitants of the same. So they brought the king word again. And it's interesting just to follow that through, because Isaiah 57 is speaking about the merciful man is taken away. You know, that's exactly the description that's given of Josiah. In the 2 Chronicles 35, verse 26, where it summarizes his reign, it says, now the rest of the acts of Josiah and his kindnesses, according to that which was written in the law of Yahweh, and his deeds, first and last, his kindnesses is the first thing mentioned. And the word is chesed. Chesed in the plural. His acts of loving kindness, of steadfast love. This was a very great man who loved his people. It's of him that the prophet is speaking in Jeremiah 22, where he says this. In Jeremiah chapter 22. Verse 15. Shalt thou reign because thou closest thyself in cedar? This is to one of his sons. But then it says in Jeremiah 22, verse 15, did not thy father, Josiah, eat and drink and do judgment and justice? And then it was well with him. He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Then it was well with him. Was not this to know me, saith Yahweh? Now there's a little statement, summary of Josiah. How would you summarise Josiah? That's how Jeremiah summarised him. And at the end of Chronicles said, his kindnesses. That's the type of man he was. So when we see that man that's climbing over all the idolatry and ransacking that terrible scourge that had grown again during the reign of Manasseh, just remember that as well as that, he was a man who loved the poor and needy and cared for them. He was a watchman that had his eyes open. He was a shepherd that indeed did defend his flock. But those qualities are gone, see. And now the righteous are in jeopardy. And you can imagine, I mean, if you were Isaiah and Manasseh's reigning and he's fanatically enthralled with the wickedness of idolatry, how would you survive? What would you say every time you opened your mouth? You were in grave predicament. So that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? The contemporary prophet, Micah, he makes similar comments. Let's just have a look at that quickly in Micah chapter 7. Woe is me, verse 1 and 2, for I am as when they have gathered the summer fruits as the grape gleanings of the vintage. There is no cluster to eat. My soul desired the first ripe fruit. The good man is perished out of the earth. The good man, the godly or merciful, says the margin. It's the same word. The merciful man is perished out of the earth, and there is none upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. They hunt every man his brother with a net. That's the contemporary prophet in his last chapter. So it all seems, doesn't it, to lead in the direction that we have supposed. Coming back now to 57 verse 2. Why is the righteous man, even though he's perished, better off? Verse 2, he shall enter into peace. They shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his uprightness. Now, as I said, this concept of peace is really the beginning and the end of the chapter. Verse 19, peace, peace. Verse 21, there is no peace, saith my God to the wicked. So this is the chapter that is promising peace to the righteous, but not to the wicked. In chapter 53, we had an earlier reference of peace. This is what he must mean by peace. 53 verse 5. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. This is a bigger peace, a more fundamental peace than security from invading armies, isn't it? This is a peace that might, in fact, see its owner lose its life, but it's got peace. This is a peace in the greatest sense, because It is secure in God who has made it. In the 26th chapter of Isaiah, we have another beautiful reference to peace in this book. In Isaiah 26 and verse 3, thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. Trust ye in Yahweh forever, for in the Lord Yahweh is everlasting strength. Lord, thou wilt ordain peace for us. Verse 12. So you say that's a peace which is still true and holds, never mind what the physical circumstances might be. So here we have a lovely little encouragement in verses 1 and 2 to the righteous who may be in fact in state of great physical danger. The time had gone when you could openly speak about the things of God. You know, we can really feel the power of these things, can't we? It's rapidly becoming such in our own society. A lot of things that God would condemn in the Word, no longer could we make public comment about very easily. What does it mean? It says they shall rest in their beds. Well, it's the grave, of course, that is the bed of their peace, of their peaceful rest, like you see on so many gravestones, R.I.P. Don't you? Rest in peace. They don't really believe it, most of them, because they really think the person's alive in heaven above, very busy about God's work. But there we are, that's part of the irony. We can understand it because, in fact, Ezekiel speaks of it in just that sort of way. Ezekiel 32, because we know the true position of the dead. But here in Ezekiel 32, it speaks of the dead nations as having a bed. They have set her a bed in the midst of the slain with all her multitude. It's interesting, isn't it? The New Testament speaks also to us about death as being a sleep. What does it mean then, each one walking in his uprightness? Is this a sleepwalk? What's the concept of it? Each one walking in his uprightness. Well, I think it rather means, if you wish to take another translation, everyone who has walked straight before him. It's not talking about a walk in one's bed. It'd be rather difficult anyway, wouldn't it? Do you want me to read that again? Everyone who has walked straight before him. Instead of each one walking in his uprightness, everyone who has walked straight before him. That's an interesting phrase. Do you sense the power of that? What's it saying? He's a good man, and he's undeterred by the changing fortunes of his society or by the changing mores and principles of his society. Let me read it again. Everyone who has walked straight before him. He has his face set like a flint, of which it says of Messiah, those very words, in chapter 50 and verse 7. I have set my face like a flint. And so everyone who has walked straight before him has that sense of conviction. In the 30th chapter, Isaiah spoke in similar terms. Beautiful to have a look at this reference now. We remember commenting at length on this reference before in chapter 30 verse 21. They said to him in chapter 30 verse 10 and 11, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits, get you out of the way, turn aside out of the path, cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. So there's a society that's wanting to just go its own way and get out of our way. Let us do what we want to do. Don't tell us what God wants us to do. Cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. We go here, we want to go there. But thine eyes, verse 21, in the future shall hear a word behind thee. Thine ears shall hear a word behind thee saying, this is the way, walk ye in it. When you turn to the right hand and when you turn to the left. And they will accept that word and go with that. So it's everyone who has walked straight before him. And in the 33rd chapter, the prophet asks the question, who will dwell with the everlasting burnings? Verse 14 of chapter 33, sinners in Zion are afraid, fearfulness hath surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? What's the answer? The answer is everyone who walks straight. Who walks straight before him. He that walketh righteously, speaketh uprightly. He that despiseth the gain of oppressions, that shaketh his hands from holding of bribes, stoppeth his ears from hearing of blood, shutteth his eyes from seeing evil. He shall dwell on high. Isn't that beautiful? In other words, never mind what goes out there in that society, never mind what the radio is saying, what the papers are saying, what the magazines are saying, the television is saying, whatever. Our direction is set. That's the direction we're going, and we keep our eyes on that goal. We're not sort of looking to go here, we're not sort of looking to go there, and to be diverted from that interest. That's what's right, and we stay with that. Isn't that a beautiful thing? In our own society, my dear brothers, what a powerful thought that is. Because the pressures are upon us everywhere to change, to conform with the generation we're among, so that things that were once the foundations of our thought have changed. And they're changing in our own Adelaide scene. No question about that. And what we want to do is to look fair square at that and see what that means for our future. Because this is the test that's coming on us. We had it at dinner on Sunday morning. They will not endure sound doctrine. That was the prophecy that was given. Well, we're in the times. It's up for everyone in his own personal life or in our family lives to consider that and consider that the course that has been set has been a good course and a faithful course, and we won't be giving it away. Because, well, never mind the turns of the world. God will give them eternal rest in his own time. So, there was a very lovely encouragement, I suppose, to Isaiah and to those who were with him, his disciples that he refers to in chapter 8, and those who were still trying to sort of keep in contact with this teaching of righteousness and uprightness and decency that was becoming a more difficult line to take in a corrupting environment. Now, I want you to notice in the next section, which is verse 3 to 13a, halfway through 13, I have no idea why the verse break was not halfway through verse 13, but that's just one of the little strange things of translators from time to time. But notice this. The first section is undoubtedly about the seed of the adulterer. Ye sons of the sorceress. The seed of the adulterer and the whore. Verse 4. Children of transgression. Verse 4. A seed of falsehood. Now that's four times that's emphasized, isn't it? So this is the family of the sorceress, if you like to use it. Use that term in verses 3 and 4. And it's the product, really, of falsehood or of idolatry. There was a Jewish tradition which said that the children that were born, or that idolatry was as if one married the idol, and so the children that come up from that are like the children of that idol. If you brought an idol to yourselves and became involved in that, it was as if you married that idol. So we have therefore this concept of the seed of the adulterer and the whore, a seed of falsehood. So, this then is referring to the general people. Whereas 56, verses 9 to 12, were about the leaders, this opening bracket of verses is about the general people. Those who, it told us in Kings, were seduced, 2 Kings 21, verse 9. They were seduced by Manasseh. And here we have them spoken of as the seed of falsehood. And there was an arrogance about their behaviour. Against whom do ye sport yourselves? Sport yourselves. Yes, they were defiant in their apostasy. Against whom make ye a wide mouth and draw out the tongue? Are ye not children of transgression, a seed of falsehood? So those expressions of wide mouth and drawing out the tongue are qualities of or notable features of derision of the right path. Not only were they now going off to their idols, but there was a boldness about what they were doing. They spoke boldly. They spoke as though it was a sport. You know, isn't that true for today? I cannot help but say again, my dear friends, these words are just as if they're written for our generation, aren't they? Why is it that men get like this? Why don't they just quietly do their evil? Because being bold about it eventually sort of encourages everybody not to have any conscience about it. No sense of worry about it. And the more that he does this or she does that, or these are bold in what they say publicly, well, the more we go along with it. And nobody eventually has any conscience. And that's exactly the environment of verse 4. There is a sense of derision involved in this word. Bolstering confidence. And so this seed of falsehood has been generated. You might like to contrast that seed of falsehood with the other seed of chapter 53 and verse 10. The suffering servant, he shall see his seed. His death will be fruitful of many. Chapter 54, we have the barren producing more than she that was the married wife. So it's very interesting to see how these turns of phrases are being continued on. In verse 5, it describes in very gross language the heady, lustful environment in which these appalling matters of idolatry were being conducted. Inflaming yourselves with idols under every green tree. The New International Version describes that as, you burn with lust among the oaks and under every spreading tree, inflaming yourselves with idols. You burn with lust among the oaks. The word idols is not really in the original. And the translators have actually recognised that, because you'll see that there's a little reference to the margin where it says with idols and it says among the oaks. Well, even that's a bit too clear for the actual Hebrew. The Hebrew is Elim, E-L-I-M. And it simply means a large tree, really. Elim, a strong ones. So some translated oaks and others translated terebrinth. But we don't really need to be overly concerned. It just means that it is a strong, large tree, inflaming themselves with idols under every green tree. Now, the other thing that's mentioned, of course, is slaying the children in the valleys under the cliffs of the rocks. So we have two causes here, really. The green tree is a term that is found so many times in reference to the Canaanite worship. Just make a reference there three times here. Deuteronomy 12 verse 2, 1 Kings 14 verse 23, Jeremiah 2 verse 20. And that's just a standard phrase. You can find quite a few other references. You know where the groves were? They had these trees around them, see? That's a very common description of the worship of Baal and of the Canaanite heathen gods generally. They were found in these groves. And the green tree so often was indicative of fertility. And so there was this sort of worship of life, of fertility, of another generation to come. And so they tried to express the fact that this was devotion, this was worship of this glorious principle of fertility. And where it came, verse 5, to slaying the children in the valleys under the cliffs of the rocks, this was under the most monstrous superstition that there was a god, Molech, who required life to be sacrificed, human life to be sacrificed. So in verse 5, you've really got an irony. You've got one worship that says we're worshipping fertility and the progeneration of the race, and you've got the other that's worshipping a god that requires the death of little children. Strange, strange thing it was. In the 2nd of Kings 23, it tells us about Molech. 2 Kings 23 verse 10. A couple of references quickly. and he defiled Tophet. It says in 2 Kings 23 verse 10, which is in the valley of the children of Hinnom, that no man might make his son or his daughter to pass through the fire to Molech. Thus did Josiah, trying to rid the effects of Manasseh's reign. I'll just give you a couple of others. We won't turn them up. We'll turn up the next one. It's the next chapter. 2 Kings 24, verses 3 and 4. Surely at the commandment of Yahweh came this upon Judah, to remove them out of his sight. Notice this. For the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he did, and also for the innocent blood that he shed. For he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, which Yahweh would not pardon. Now that innocent blood may have been the prophets, but we know that it also was innocent children. So it might have been both those things. It's not so described. But notice verse 4, what means that it became a profound symbol of the reign of Manasseh. There was a lot of evil slang, butchering, as the word means in Isaiah 57 verse 5. Slaying the children. They were butchered. It was a kind of behaviour you might expect out of Herod. That's how he was treating young children in his devotion to this system. But you see, the other reference, by the way, is Jeremiah 32 verse 35. We won't turn that one up. But you see, Isaiah's not fooled about whether this is worship. He says that you're doing this in your lusts, burning with lust. This is not worship. This is not the devotion to a God. This is a self-seeking burning of lust, because associated with all of these things was this very carnal atmosphere in which they were all involved. So also in verse 6, among the smooth stones of the stream is thy portion. So though up there on the cliffs of the rocks in verse 5, in the valleys under the cliffs of the rocks, among the smooth stones of the stream in the very bottom of the valley. And he says, they are thy lot. Even to them hast thou poured a drink offering. Thou hast offered a meat offering. If that's your portion, verse 6, then you can have it, says God. They are thy lot. You want that? That's your portion, verse 6? Well, you can have your portion if that's what you want. Because Yahweh was really their portion. Remember, twice it says in Psalm 16, verse 5, and Psalm 119, verse 57, we won't turn them up, but it says, Yahweh is our portion, our lot. Beautiful reference. But he says, if you want the portion that these gods can give you, then you can have it. Should I receive comfort in these, says God at the end of verse 6. That is to say, should I relent? Should I relieve from my judgment about those matters? Should I change my mind? Should I repent? The translation is somewhat obscure. Should I receive comfort in these? That's the sense of it. Should I relent about what I think about this behaviour? In Leviticus chapter 20, he had said what he thought about that behaviour. It must have been there even before they came into the land. In Leviticus 20 and verse 2 to 5, it says again, thou shalt say to the children of Israel, whosoever he be of the children of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that giveth any of his seed unto Molech, he shall surely be put to death. Remember what the psalm says, the children are a heritage of Yahweh. Psalm 127 and verse 3. And so God says, any who offers that seed unto Molech, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. And I will set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people. because he hath given of his seed unto Molech to defile my sanctuary, to profane my holy name. And if the people of the land do in any ways hide their eyes from the man, when he giveth of his seed unto Molech and kill him not, then I will set my face against that man. And now, would you believe, the nation has become affected by it. So that even the king is seducing the people into following that which God so obviously despised. And the blatancy of this matter is powerfully evidenced, say, verse 7, upon a lofty and high mountain hast thou set thy bed. Thy bed. In other words, there is brazen adultery. And it's associated, obviously, with the idolatry, with the iniquity of the idolatry. Adultery and idolatry, therefore, went together, as, of course, they always have. So they're going to salace their desires in the most blazing light upon the high and lofty mountain. So in the valleys beneath, verse 5, or in the streams, verse 6, or in the top of the mountains, Judah has become saturated with filth. And of course, this is all terribly, terribly relevant to Manasseh's own period of time. Then verse 8 says, behind the doors also, and the posts hast thou set up thy remembrance. Do you remember what was supposed to be remembered by what was on the doors and the posts? The word of God was supposed to be remembered, wasn't it? In Deuteronomy 6. There's surely a little play upon those things. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, and thou shalt write then, verse 9, upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. That is the commandments of God. But in contrast distinction to that, now those posts and those doors, they have other things written upon them, things related to the idolatry. They have forgotten their God, they have gone away to other things. For thou hast, verse 8, uncovered thyself to another than me, and art gone up. Thou hast enlarged thy bed, and made thee a covenant with them. Thou lovest their bed where thou sawest it. There is a real wantonness in their idolatry. Notice the reference to bed. It's in verse 7, it's in verse 8, and it's a second time in verse 8. That's three times. It is the bed, of course, of idolatry, or the bed of adultery. And it's in very brilliant contrast with the bed of verse 2. Because you won't find the word very often, will you, in the record of Scripture. But here in this chapter, there's four references. And three are to the bed of adultery, and the other is to the bed of divine rest and security. The memorial grave, as John expresses it in John chapter 5. So that's very beautiful indeed. Now, what then is verse 9 referring to? Are we still talking about individuals involved in fornication and adultery associated with idolatry? And thou wentest to the king with ointment, and didst increase thy perfumes, and didst send thy messengers far off, and didst debase thyself even unto hell. Thou art wearied in the greatness of thy way, yet saidst thou not, there is no hope. This now is referring to what we might call a national adultery. Not literal adultery, but as there was idolatry and natural adultery associated with that, as there were prostitutes and they had prostituted themselves, so the nation as a whole, lacking the security that God of Israel could give them, they then went to look for other causes of security. other husbands, that is, to other nations. And Ahaz would be the classic case. 2 Kings chapter 16, verse 7. In that record, you can see, therefore, that it's merged from one into the other. And the reason, obviously, is that if you give God away, then you've got to look somewhere else, and the nation look for some other form of security. So in 2 Kings 16 and verse 7, Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am thy servant and thy son. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Syria and out of the hand of the king of Israel, which rise up against me. That's a classic illustration of what Isaiah is saying. In other words, in Manasseh's time, he's going to make relationship with other countries. Not looking unto the God of Israel, he's going to seek to find security, national security, in the other nations that can help him as he sees it. In politics, in other words, in human politics. In Ezekiel 16, speaking again in the sense of national fornication or adultery, it says in Ezekiel 16, verse 28, Thou hast played the whore also with the Assyrians, because thou wast unsatiable. Verse 29, Thou hast moreover multiplied thy fornication in the land of Canaan unto Chaldea, and yet thou wast not satisfied therewith. So Assyria, Chaldea, or Canaan, or the Egyptians, verse 26, Israel will go anywhere for some form of security rather than hold on to the God that they had and who was prepared to deliver them. And so they sent their messengers around. So verse 9 is speaking about ambassadors who were sent long distances with presents to the king, who in this case, verse 9, was probably the king of Assyria or the king of Babylon or someone in whom they could put their trust. It's the same, you might note, as Isaiah 30, verse 2, where they sent messengers or ambassadors to Egypt. And in verse 10, it speaks of their journeys. They are wearied in the greatness of thy way. In other words, the journeys were long. The point of that is distance. They are wearied in the greatness, in the length of thy way. They sent many people with various presents. It was an arduous and difficult thing. But it never succeeded. There was never anybody that would back Judah. Yet saidst thou not, there is no hope. They had never recognized the obvious. Thou hast found the life of thine hand. That is to say, you've got sufficient. You've got sufficient security, as it were, you feel, to be able to do what you want to do and reach the goals that you want. Thou hast found the life of thy hand, therefore thou wast not grieved. And you know, that's exactly like our generation today. I often wonder, you know, when I see them on Sunday morning, and they're all going somewhere, and there's a lot of people on the road, think, where are all these people going? What are they doing on Sundays? What do they want to do? They have got no interest in going to some place of worship, have they? But as long as they've got sufficient ability to do what they want to do, and go where they want to go, they'll blind their eyes to the obvious. And that's our society, isn't it, to a T. Absolutely to a T. I wonder what they do with their time. If you didn't have the truth, what would life be about? What would you do with your time? What's there worth pursuing? They're running around like crazy. Anything they can find. Bingo, and they'll play it, you know. Just the craziest things you can think of. Sport, they're just mad on sport. Anybody can enjoy a good game. But they're crazy about sport, aren't they? It's all life's about. Kicking a ball around. Some other thing. And the whole point of life is lost. Well, verse 10 is exactly like that. They didn't want to know the difference. They had their heads down and they could achieve their goals. And so they just went headlong with that. And yet inwardly they knew there was nothing in it. And there'll be so many of our society like that. But you try and tell them to pull them out, and you'll find that they're very often just not grieved sufficiently. They just dredge on from one day to another. unerring about life eternal, not interested. And as long as their present financial balance is satisfactory, then they're happy. That's how Israel was. Of whom, verse 11, this is a sad verse, of whom hast thou been afraid or feared that thou hast lied and hast not remembered me? What nation is it that has put you to fear that you think you have to go and run somewhere else to make an agreement? Remember what he said in the 51st chapter, verse 13? And forgettest Yahweh thy Maker, that hath stretched forth the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth, and hast feared continually every day because of the fury of the oppressor. My people worried about an oppressor as if he were ready to destroy. And God rebukes and he says, and where is the fury of the oppressor? If you're my people, why do you have to be worried about that? Who are you? Says Isaiah. If you're my people, you don't have to be worried about that. Where's the fury of the oppressor? It ceases to exist. It's no concern of us, is it? If God is our God and in him we put our trust. Beautiful words. There are very similar words in the Psalm 50. Have not I held my peace even of old, and thou fearest me not, said God, as he completed that thought. You know, if he had brought judgments upon them, then they might have returned. So in chapter 50, verse 21, it says about all of their evils, and then says, these things hast thou done, and I kept silence. Thou thoughtest that I was altogether such a one as thyself, but I will reprove thee and set them in order before thine eyes. And it's a very similar thought that we've got in 57 of Isaiah, verse 11. Have not I held my peace, even of old, and thou fearest me not? I was good to you, but you turned away your heart from me because of that very thing. Then he says in verse 12 and the first part of 13, I will declare thy righteousness and thy works, for they shall not profit thee. You won't get away with this abandonment, and neither will our own world. Always think about that, young people. Always remember that. Don't envy what they've got. They will not get away with it. When thou criest, verse 13, let thy companies deliver thee. In other words, your collections. It means the collections of their idols, all those that are mentioned. And those that are catalogued for us in 2 Chronicles 33, verse 3 to 6. Remember all those things. That's the collections. When thou criest, let thy collections deliver thee. But the wind shall carry them all away. Vanity shall take them. In other words, they won't stand up. And you know how true that is today. It'll just pass away, won't it? All the things that people have put their trust in. The business world, the sport world, the political world, all of those things, they will just pass away. Now the third section, but he that putteth his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. That's what they wanted. They wanted to possess the land. They wanted to possess it eternally. That's what they're worried about. And they wanted Jerusalem. They shall inherit my holy mountain. The dwellers in Jerusalem were always special. Nehemiah, they're specially noted in Nehemiah 12. These people will inherit my holy mountain. What are they doing? Putting their trust in me. They're the righteous, you see, of verse 1 and 2. Entering into peace. And shall say, just by the way, look at verse 13 in the light of today, that second half. Isn't that a powerful thing? They want to possess the land, then let them put their trust in God. They want to inherit Jerusalem, let them put their trust in him. And shall say, this is God saying, cast ye up, prepare the way. Take up the stumbling block out of the way of my people. In other words, God is making a passage for these humble but trusting people. It's the same that we've got in chapter 40, where a highway is prepared for his people to make it possible, even in their smallness and their humility, God will make it possible for them to find eternal life. For thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity. Now that's a grand phrase. Just try and take that in. The high and lofty one. That being verse 7. In lofty and high mountains with idolatry. But this one is the high and lofty one that inhabits eternity. Where's that? That's where he inhabits. And so the ultimate greatness of God is then to come upon and find its habitation, verse 15, I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. So the very ultimate highest dwells with the lowest and humblest of men. What a magnificent statement that is. And John 14 verse 10 and 23 fit in there so beautifully, where we have the promise of Christ dwelling in us by faith. And so that inner contentment described in verses 1 and 2 is now amplified. Here is a habitation which is true security. Never mind the invader, never mind the circumstances of life. Make a little note there to look up Psalm 113 verse 6. It also fits very beautifully. Where it says, I dwell in the high and holy place, that's the word that we have in respect to the tabernacle or the temple, Shaken. Remember the Shekinah glory? Well, this is the same word, except this is the verb of that word. And so the Shekinah glory can be in any humble and contrite person. Even though he inhabits the very highest, yet he will come to the very lowest. Beautiful thoughts. For says God, I will not contend forever, neither will I be always wroth, because they are but men. For the spirit, that is the spirit of men, should fail before me, and the souls which I have made. He knows our frame. He made us. He is the God of the spirits of all flesh. Numbers 27 verse 16. So he understands, and he will not therefore contend forever. There is good things coming. What about verse 17? To whom might this refer? For the iniquity of his covetousness was I wroth and smote him. Who is that? I hid me and was wroth, and he went on frowardly in the way of his heart. Well, that's surely the one in verse 11 of whom he said, have not I held my peace? I hid me and was wroth, and he went on frowardly in the way of his heart. I have seen his ways, it's Israel, isn't it? And will heal him. I will lead him also and restore comforts unto him and to his mourners. Chapter 40 verse 1 to 2, comfort ye my people. So whilst the contention will go on, verse 17 and 18, whilst not mentioning Israel by name, clearly have reference to someone who has gone off on its own way. God says, in time I will yet heal him, and I will lead him also and restore comforts unto him and to his mourners. I create the fruit of the lips, that is praise. On what score is praise generated? It's the fruit of the lips is spoken of as praise, isn't it? Hebrews 13 verse 15. So God is speaking then something good. And he says, I create the fruit of the lips, a cause of praise. What is that cause of praise? It is peace. What every man wants it forever. And what's more, it's for everyone. Everyone who would. Peace, peace. To him that is far off, the Gentile, and to him that is near, the Jew, saith the Lord. And I will heal him. So that's the one of verse 18. But it's a much more general application. 18 and 17, referring to Israel, will come in after this more general calling. And I will heal him. But the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There's the contrast with that sea of glass of Revelation 15. It's the waters are the upon which the whore sat are peoples and multitudes and tongues, aren't they? It's the evilness of the world in which we live. And they're like a troubled sea, says God, which is forever stirring up dirt and filth. Isn't that true of today? All the media of the world are forever stirring all that up and putting it into the minds of men. And then they put it into the minds of our children at school and other places. And God says, whilst I create the fruit of the lips with a good message of peace, don't think that I'm asleep anymore. There is no peace, however, saith my God to the wicked. God will balance it out, and those who have been faithful to him will be vindicated. But he will not toy with wickedness. It's a very powerful chapter, isn't it, in the world in which we live today, in which there is contentment and happiness and peace are spoken to those that are faithful to our calling. My dear brothers and sisters, it comes really down, doesn't it, to every minute of our day. When we're constantly in the world, we've got to think about those things. Are we shifting with the world in which we're living? Or is our mind clear and free of all that stuff? If you're at home and you've got just your own environment, it's a real blessing, a real blessing. If you're out in the world, that's a challenge, because the office doesn't think like that. They think very differently. And all the things they're interested in, not the things that we should be interested in. And God's aware of that, and he's going to vindicate his cause. He's going to vindicate that for certain. And all the noise they make, which generates their sort of their confidence in the progress of evil, that'll all come to an end. And those that have stayed by God, he will remember and give to them that eternal peace of the age to come. Thank you.